I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today we are talking about The Mummy, the 1999 version, directed by Stephen Sommers, screenplay by Stephen Sommers, based on the 1932 The Mummy, which I only learned today. We can talk about more of that. I'm joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
Okay, so we're talking about The Mummy, which we've been very excited about because Trisha, Alex, and I, anyway, I think this movie holds a special place in our hearts. Mm-hmm. I think we all saw it when it came out. So I'm going to pick on you, Brian,
okay,
because you did not see it when it came out. You saw it recently. So I want just like the fresh 2021 take. What did you
the
make?
The hottest take of them all.
This movie.
I mean, it's funny, right? There's this running theme of me watching movies for the first time now that I didn't see when I was a teenager, you know. So it's like I saw The Iron Giant for the first time and I loved it, and I saw Mulan for the first time and I loved it, and I saw The Mummy for the first time. Yeah, it was fine. No, I think it's funny because it is one of those things where it's like I could definitely see how this would help to have a sort of teenage experience to sort of tie to this movie. You know, Michael, we were talking off camera about The Fifth Element, and you're like, based on the clips that you've seen, you have no interest in watching this like ridiculous movie, right? And I, as someone who loves that movie, I'm like, no, but 15-year-old me comes out when I watch this movie and has such a good time.
Right.
Also, it's incredibly stupid sort of by design, right? And it's like, there's no part of me that would argue with somebody who saw The Fifth Element for the first time today and said, well, that was just like, I didn't enjoy that at all. I'd be like, yeah, I get that, you know? So I think that was sort of my experience with The Mummy. It's this sort of, it was like, I was really ready for just a fun, you know, because this was back when movies were fun, right?
Right. Like, what a time.
Yeah, which hasn't happened much in the past decade or so. Even like the superhero movies aren't fun, right?
Right.
So yeah, I was like all ready to have a good time. And then it was just, it keeps pushing the boundary of where I enjoy the comedy, basically. It's like any movie that has the bookshelf ladder sequence, I'm like, that's just probably not a movie for me. You know, the mummy.
It's so good. It's a long take. They did it in camera.
The mummy juggling his head, you know, and then Brendan Fraser like hits it and goes towards camera. I think the problem with me the first time I watched it, I sort of like 2x watched it basically earlier today to kind of remember it and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And the first time was, I was just like, I'm having such a hard time settling into where is this movie trying to be tonally, right? Is if it's trying to be just a crazy slapstick comedy, okay, but then you've got to do that consistently, but it's not. It's sort of like, look, we're a serious kind, not serious, but like we're sort of a standard adventure movie, and now we're this zany comedy, but now we're like doing this thing, and now we're telling you this backstory, you know. And it sort of jumps all over the place. And sort of scrubbing through it again, knowing what it was, I was able to just enjoy it and have fun and that kind of thing. So I could see it being a movie that I would like upon rewatching. But just the first time, I was just like, I can't kind of settle into this. And it just, you know, it didn't quite work for me.
I think that is perfectly reasonable.
Sure.
I think it was very fascinating revisiting The Mummy because I hadn't seen it in a long time. But I did watch it a lot when it came out, when I was, you know, 13, 14, all that stuff. And also having this kind of experience where I think I'd almost like redacted sections of it in my brain. Sure. And so I was like, I was really excited to go back and I'm going to watch The Mummy. It's so much fun. It's such a great adventure. And then there would be these weird left turns tonally, like you're talking about. And I was like, oh, I forgot that that's in this. Or I thought that was in the sequel, which I've decided is not good and not part of the. So it was very weird having to reconcile my memory of The Mummy and what it actually is now. I still think it's pretty cool. I think I've kind of classified it as like, I don't know that it's good, but it's kind of great also. And I think the tonal mess ultimately kind of averages out into something that's like fun and works for me. But yeah, Alex and Trisha, I'm curious to hear what your guys' experience was then and now and how you kind of feel about all of these things. Alex, do you want to share thoughts?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, all I know is I watched it a ton back in the day. Like I
it's one of those movies from that era that I just watched over and over and over again. So it's seared in my brain, you know, like The Matrix, like other movies from that, you know, that magical year, 1999. It was part of that collection that I was just like super influential on me as a like aspiring filmmaker. I don't even know if I had like an objective perspective on it back then. Like I wasn't really aware of the genre tropes it was playing with, besides it was kind of like Indiana Jones, you know, and I wasn't aware of even like the idea of it maybe being kind of a B movie that has a huge budget, which I think is a really interesting way to think about it, because Universal originally wanted to make a pretty low budget mummy movie, just thinking of it as like a B horror movie, basically.
Right.
And Stephen Sommers came to them with this like bigger, you know, Indiana Jones style pitch. And they liked it so much, they blew the budget up to $80 million. And so you get this movie that feels free to be a B movie, you know, where it's not taking itself too seriously. It's kind of all over the place. It's kind of grotesque in a lot of these weird ways. It goes to these horror places that don't seem like they belong in the same movie, with this kind of fun and games lightheartedness. And all of that combines into this really special, one-of-a-kind thing that... Even at the time, I do remember feeling like, wow, this is strange. This movie both has this and this in it. Like I wasn't used to movies having this kind of grotesquerie, but also this kind of cute, you know, innocence at other times.
Like charm.
The charm, yeah.
So much charm. Charm in spades.
So all that is to say, yeah, it's hard to even speak about the movie from a super objective place, because I feel like I've been in it too much. But it was fun to revisit it and be able to see it with kind of my like film language knowledge now, and see all the places it's pulling from so directly, and think about like what a rare thing it was at the time. We talked about Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl, being this rare, pure adventure film, you know, with a twist with zombie pirates. This is very similar. The finale feels very similar to Pirates of the Caribbean with zombie mummies and you know, a curse you have to break to like kill the bad guy and all these things,
make him mortal and then you can kill him for real.
So yeah, it's an artifact of this time where we still had adventure movies, and I forgot that this existed before Pirates, and it almost seems like a prototype for Pirates in a lot of ways. Lots of thoughts.
Trisha?
I feel very similar to you, Alex, in that, like, this is such a part of my, like, DNA at this point that I don't know how to talk about it in any way other than just, like, I love this movie. I love this movie so much. Is it a good movie? That question is so far beyond me, and I'm also not even interested in it. Like, I'm not interested in that question at all. Like, it is just a ridiculous amount of fun, this movie, to me. And, like, obviously, it, like, everything in me personally responds to it. It's this swashbuckle, like, action, adventure, period thing with, like, a plucky heroine and, like, lots of action sequences, way too many, like... The plot doesn't make any sense the way it winds through all of these action sequences. There's a huge, like, riverboat action sequence that you forget is in this movie. And it's great. Like,
yeah,
that sequence is really fun.
All of these action sequences are so much fun and really great. And they're packed in there. And it only sort of holds together because of Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz's performances. But those performances have such magnetism and also delight to them that they really just hold you, and they hold this movie. And the, I don't know, all the just like horror elements, it's so splashy and like sort of technicolor, you know, 30s adventure. Allow me to quote Roger Ebert here from his review from 1999, which begins, "There is within me an unslaked hunger for preposterous adventure movies." And that is exactly how I feel about this. And then he goes on to say about The Mummy, "There is hardly a thing I can say in its favor, except that I was cheered by nearly every minute of it."
Right.
"I cannot argue for the script, the direction, the acting, or even The Mummy, but I can say that I was not bored, and sometimes I was unreasonably pleased." There is...
That's great. Roger Ebert.
Yes, yes, beautiful. Yes. The last line of that opening paragraph reads, "There is a little immaturity stuck away in the crannies of even the most judicious of us, and we should treasure it."
Yes, beautiful.
I treasure this movie.
Right, that's just the best way to put that, right? Like, just, I can't argue any of this is good, but man, I had a good time.
Wow, I love it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
When it feels like the movie is operating on that level, on all the levels, like that's how every part of it feels. It's mm-hmm. like, yeah, none of this is good, but it's all kind of great.
Mm-hmm.
And so watching it again today, because I watched it a couple, maybe like a month and a half ago, and then watched it again today, trying to kind of pick apart what are some of the things that do work when they're working. And the performances, obviously, Rachel Weisz and Brendan Fraser are, I find them immensely charming. They got a really fun, like, Han Solo, Leia kind of vibe going on. Like, it's great. But I also appreciated in the directing and the staging that a lot of the gags and their commitment to the gags, like talking about the Rachel Weisz accidentally knocking down a room full of books and that it all being practical and in a single take, or even just on that riverboat fight, you know, there's a shootout happening and Brendan Fraser's, you know, reloading his gun and you see a bullet hole hit the wall that he's hiding behind, and another, it's coming closer and closer, and then she reaches and pulls him out of the way for the last one. Like, mm-hmm. all these things are just really, like, fun. Like, there's a lot of care put into each one of the, like, these gags, and in some ways it almost feels like a play. Like, now I'm thinking about, you know, after they release the mummy and then they go back to the city, Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz are arguing in their room, and you know, it's that thing where, like, he's packing up the bags and she's unpacking the bags.
Mm. That one really stuck out to me. Yeah.
Right. And it's all kind of in this, like, long wide shot, and you get to see the characters like relationships play in real time and the staging of all of it. I feel like there's all of that goes a long way to kind of creating the adventure and like you're saying, Trisha, the magnetism between them and the performances. We get to, like, spend time in it and watch it play out and let them tell the story in these just really well-crafted sequences that, yeah, maybe don't make sense one-to-one-to-one as you watch them in order, but within each one are really great.
Mm-hmm.
It actually reminded me a lot of Temple of Doom, which we'll talk about when we get to 750 patrons, everyone. Mm-hmm. But that's a movie I loved a bunch as a kid, and people say it's, like, the worst of the only three Indiana Jones movies. And but, like, it also has that sequence where he and Kate Capshaw are arguing in the hallway, and then they each close their door and stuff like that.
Right.
But then he's being strangled, I think, and then she comes to the door and she's, like, still arguing and he's, like, fighting mm-hmm. for his life, or that kind of thing. It sort of has that fun to it, which, again, if I had seen The Mummy when I was a kid and Temple of Doom for the first time right now, I might have opposite opinions of those movies, you know. But it's just, like, that was my experience as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Well, it feels like The Mummy in general really is paying homage, a really loving homage to old Hollywood,
right?
You know, Errol Flynn adventure. Mm-hmm. And it includes the kind of screwball comedy of the romance. I took a note in the opening sequence, like the flashback to, like, this, you know, the old Egypt flashback and you know, the kind of the sets and the costumes. It was like old Hollywood, but with, like, sexy 90s skin, you know? Anusana Moon walks in and she's, like, basically naked. And it was like this really fun, like, mishmash of kind of campy old style filmmaking with, like, a 90s edge, which I really enjoy.
Yeah. Even those sequences where, you know, all the practical sets where everything is just, like, fake stone draped in fake moss and, like, sand is flying everywhere and, like, all of this stuff, you know, the stuff that doesn't have the CGI sort of beetles in it or whatever, the stuff that's all just sort of, like, practical old school stunt work and, mm-hmm,
right.
You know, Hollywood, like, we built this on a lot. Here are the catacombs and, you know, all the walls move and stuff like that. That is exactly what you're talking about. That creates that old timey feeling.
I think as I've gotten older, there are movies where when I watch an action movie, sometimes as a, like, teenage boy, I was like, I don't care about the dialogue. I'm going to go do something. And now's the action scene. And I've almost gotten reversed where I'm like, oh, it's just the action. Nothing's really going to happen here. Obviously, there are movies with amazing action scenes that I want to watch. But sometimes there are movies where it's just like, okay, this chase sequence has gone on for 10 minutes or whatever. And The Mummy definitely felt like one of those movies where the action scenes were just so fun that I was having a great time during all of them. I'm like, oh, man, I'm so back into this. And, like, I kind of maybe tuned out for a second, but, like, now I'm totally on board. And that is mostly the practical stuff, because then the CG is, ooh boy, it's rough. I remember in 2001 being at my friend's and we were watching The Tonight Show, and Brendan Fraser was on for Mummy Returns. and he's setting up the clip, and he's like, they can do everything with computers now. So in the clip you're about to see, we're being chased by these demons, but they're all computer, like they're computer made. So they weren't actually there. And he sets this whole thing up, and then they show the clip, and it's just the worst CG. Like even in 2001, my friend and I were like, oh wow, nobody in their right mind would think like, how did they do that?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was like the Rock body double in that movie, right?
Right.
As the Scorpion King.
Was that the second or the third?
He appears for the first time in Mummy Returns. Then they did a prequel about the Scorpion King.
Right.
But I feel like the infamous shot of like the scorpion with the body and face of the Rock is from like the Mummy Returns.
Very low resolution. Yeah.
Right.
Worst CG. And in some ways, I feel like it kind of, you know, Alex, you're talking about the sort of taking the old and mixing it with the new. I feel like ultimately the visual effects work for me in that mode in The Mummy, not in The Mummy Returns. Mm-hmm.
But I agree with you. It's kind of in the same way that it still works for me in Pirates. There's something about the way the CG mummies look that it's obviously CG, but it's not in a way that takes me out of the fun of the action. Like I'm still mm-hmm. enjoying watching Brandon Fraser like knock away all these CG, you know, skeleton things away from Rachel Weisz.
I don't know. And I think maybe in this case for me, it goes back to what I was talking about earlier, where the old school effects don't look real either. They look different. They look old school, but they look like they're from the 30s kind of. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they're supposed to like I said, the rocks don't look like real heavy rocks, like, and that kind of thing. It looks like a set and it's lit like a set. And, you know, except for the stuff that they did shoot on location, which all looks great and everything. But yeah, all that catacomb stuff where the huge statue falls and, you know, they're like having these like books and these like built props that have mm-hmm. a prop-like quality to them that are
right.
not real. They are Hollywood props. And so when you combine things like that with CG, where you can see how it's fake, right? There's a sort of equal level of fakeness, I feel,
right.
that kind of just combines and feels tonally sort of consistent in spite of itself.
It's something I remember talking about with my friends when The Phantom Menace came out, where I was like, look, the CG's not good, but it kind of fits in the world of this movie because everything is sort of candy colored and insane, right? So the CG isn't as off-putting as the Harry Potter movie or something where everything is like meant to look very dark and then suddenly there's this cartoon running around and you're like, that doesn't look quite right.
Mm-hmm. Something I was thinking about watching it again also was, you know, the phrase set pieces, right? Like you want your movie to have really good set pieces. And like you're saying, Trisha, like these are very literally set pieces where you yeah. feel like, okay, there was a scene, they built a set and this set is for this scene. But then they like, you know, milk it for all it's worth. Like, you know, we're talking about the riverboat scene. Like that's a really fun set piece that has everything you want from, like you get to spend some time there and get the little exposition and then you get to watch them burn it all down and blow it up. And I feel like that rhythm is just so fun.
That sequence makes me feel like I'm at Disneyland. Like that, about, like, the boat sequence, I'm like, this is an amazing Disneyland place slash ride slash experience. And I just want to like be here for a while. And so I'm so glad we get to be there for a while.
Right.
Actually, you're identifying, I think, what I'm trying to put my finger on, Alex, which is the feeling of being immersed in a fantasy world while being reminded that it's fantasy constantly and the fun that that can be. Where it's not trying to act grounded, you know? And so everything about this movie tonally contributes to that feeling where there's, you know, everyone's like a little too fast with a quip and too good at this and that. And, you know, tone, the humor is really present, obviously. I feel like that just sort of is the fun of the ride that makes it, gives it this ride-like feeling that also Pirates of the Caribbean, the movie, mm-hmm. has and so Stephen Sommers, who wrote and directed this movie The Mummy, also made a version of The Jungle Book in 1994, which we were talking about a little bit earlier today in the Slack because I forgot remembered about that it existed. I know
Lena Headey is in it, like,
yes,
what?
Yes, I mean it's like it's great to my recollection. I have not seen it in 20 years. I'm sure it is not great, but my little heart loved it the way that I love The Mummy. But I was thinking, I was like describing it to someone today, and I was like, this is what I wish the Jungle Cruise movie would be, right? Like, the Jungle Cruise movie is not going to be like the Jungle Book from 1994, but I wish that it were going to be like that. I wish that we're going to lean into this, like, get on this, sort of quaint, old-fashioned, like, genre ride and, like, have a good time while you're in it. Which the Indiana Jones ride at Disneyland also feels that way very much.
Right.
I feel the problem now is, there's this kind of, like, the Mummy, for example, is huge. Like, this movie goes way farther than you ever think it will. I mean, it has the apocalypse happening. It has the biblical plagues, like things you never like signed up for. This movie it goes there, but somehow it also feels like it's within this, I don't know, this universe, this bubble that we're in, and it feels coherent in its craziness. One of my problems with some of these remakes or reboots or just, we got to take this IP and like make an even bigger thing out of it and put it in IMAX. Somehow the bigness leaves the sphere that I want to be in, and it goes to this other place. And so Jungle Cruise, I don't know what that movie's going to be like, but I'm scared that it's going to be like, it turns out it's a fantasy, like alternate universe where, you know, there's actually like magical jungle fairies. And it's like, there's a whole political thing with the jungle fairies. Like, they're going to try to make it way more than what it could be, which is just a really fun throwback Jungle Cruise adventure. You know, like, maybe that's okay too, instead of whatever all this IP building stuff is.
It's a scale issue that I feel like modern movies run into constantly, where it's like, the world is going to end, and then the world is going to end, and then the universe is going to end. Half of all life in the universe is, you know, going to end. It keeps blowing up and blowing up, and you lose touch with the characters, I think, when that happens. And I think that one of the smartest things this movie does, as we touched on earlier, is keep us focused on Rick and on Evie and their love story. And there's like really only sort of three characters we really care about, them and, you know, Jonathan sort of, and then some of the others here and there. But a lot of those people are really just there to get killed. Right. And so
the Americans,
Benny is a great, you know, kind
Benny
of
is, yeah,
evil, henchman person. Yeah.
But it does stay. I think that's what you're talking about, Alex. The scale, you know, even while there are locusts flying everywhere, the scale still feels small because we know what Imhotep wants. And it's Evie.
Right.
And so, like, that's a very focused sort of small sort of goal for the villain that we can. And, you know, he and the hero are competing for the same goal.
Right.
So
it's very smart to make it about the characters themselves. It's not about Imhotep wants to conquer the world. He wants this one specific person that we care about.
Yep.
I was thinking also about verisimilitude. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that also has happened in the last 20 years with movies, is it like it's about the end of the world and it needs to feel like it's really about the end of the world. And like things need to feel real and you have to believe this world, even though it's completely unbelievable. And I think that's what's kind of refreshing about The Mummy, is like there's enough there that you can believe in this movie. But at no point do I feel like the movie is trying to make me accept the reality that these characters are in is my reality, or that it could ever be.
Right.
Right. It's like if suddenly we cut to a news anchor explaining what was going on, it would just feel like this movie is insane, but you're not. You're with the people the whole time, you know? And it's also a very slow build where you have the expositional intro and then you have the opening scene with Rick. And then you have half a movie, right? Of just sort of like, exploring
before the
stuff,
mummy wakes up. Yeah.
Right. Before like the midpoint, of course. And then even then, for like the second half of the second act, we're only with those few characters in the tomb, that kind of thing. So then it's not until the third act where all hell breaks loose. And by then you've bought it. And as you were saying, Tricia, the world can end in the third act. It's a problem when the world is ending at the inciting incident and then just has to keep ending for the rest of the movie. And like they have to keep one upping themselves, like Pacific Rim, the, you know, the mech punching the kaiju into space or whatever, where it's like, okay.
The movie doesn't try to explain how the plagues are working, or like how all the water
certainly
and alcohol turned into blood. Like, we don't cut to the Pentagon being like, we're seeing activity over Egypt, right? You know, it's like there's no sense of like an external universe that is like concerned with what's happening. It's just happening locally here. We don't know where the locust came from or how it even works. It's just happening. And that's really refreshing, and what a relief.
Well, and that's exactly what I was thinking too about it when I was watching it this time. When we talked about Pirates of the Caribbean, which is a Patreon episode, we were discussing the mechanics. Like, I don't know, I got really interested in the mechanics, like the magic in Pirates of the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And like, what are the pieces that you need to do the curse, right? Like, how are the objects related? Who has them? Where are they? You have to keep track of that. I think Pirates does a great job of that. The Mummy does a terrible job of that.
Right.
Like, I've watched this movie 50 times, and I can't tell you, like, okay, so he needs the jars, the organ jars. Are the organs right in them? Clearly not, because now he's taking organs from other people. And then, like, he has the power of the plagues. Not all of them, apparently, because there's only, like, four we see. Yeah, it's, like, half the plagues, but definitely not all. They come at random times. Sometimes he's there actually controlling them. Sometimes he's not anywhere near them, not really controlling them at all.
He's sand sometimes. He's just
sometimes
sand.
He's made of sand. He's afraid of cats, up until a certain point.
Right.
How does any of this relate to, you know, like the ceremony that he needs to bring Atnaxuna Moon back to life? Don't worry about that. There's just so many pieces that you need for the machine. The mechanics of the mummy are a disaster. But we don't care because Rick and Evie are people that we love. And like, ultimately, we can track with, okay, the mummy is trying to get Evie. We got it. And there's that simplicity to staying focused on the characters. It gets you stuff. Like, as the screenwriter, you get some of that. We're going to have the 10 plague scene now. And you kind of get it for free without having to explain it, by staying focused on the characters and scaling it down and keeping it small. Smart.
I just love when it suddenly cuts to a wide shot of Cairo and there's like a million fireballs raining down. It goes from like 0 to 100 in like a second. It's like plagues now.
There aren't really consequences.
There are never consequences to any of the plagues.
No. Yeah. I think the little prologue that begins the movie helps kind of set this tonality also, because that whole sequence is pretty bonkers if you try to follow it.
Oh yeah,
too much. And I just don't understand. Of like, so he was so bad. You're gonna use this curse on him, but like you could have just killed him. But instead, you're gonna do the curse that has the like asterisks. You know, once in 3,000 years, it might bring about the end of the world. Like that feels. I don't know. The decision making doesn't make any sense.
Was it worth it to curse him with this? This is a possible consequence.
Right. And it's so melodramatic.
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of why it works ultimately for me, is that it is drawing your focus, even the way it's shot, away from like, don't worry about like thinking about what's happening too much here. The important part is this melodrama of these lovers that couldn't be and killed the pharaoh, and she's going to sacrifice herself, and like it's helping point your attention to these are the things this story is going to care about, these other things maybe not so much.
Yeah
I think that was a weird thing for me. It was like watching the movie for the first time, that exposition scene was cool, and I was like, okay, cool, I get what happened here and all this stuff. And then we cut to the battle sequence, which is a lot of fun, but then it's sort of like, oh, by the way, this movie's like insane and goofy and that kind of thing. I was like, oh, okay, because you just showed me like a really long, like very melodramatic, you know. But I really do like the way that sequence sets up Brendan Fraser's character. He's sort of more of an everyman, right? Because he's like, he's not a coward, but he's scared. He's not going to stand there and just try to fight 100 people. He's going to run for his life. It's sort of a way of saying, this isn't Harrison Ford or Tom Cruise. And this is more of like kind of a hero, but also kind of a guy. And I think like Brendan Fraser is a good casting for that kind of a role, you know? And one thing that surprised me is, as a fan of Airheads and Encino Man, I was not expecting a long-haired Brendan Fraser in this movie, but I got that. And that was just a really nice little icing on the cake, was just like long-haired, you know, off the rails, don't know what he's going to do next, Brendan Fraser. I was like, oh, cool.
Oh, the jail sequence?
For like exactly. A minute. Yeah.
For like a minute, but it was 1 minute more than I was expecting. So I was, I was on board for it.
I don't love his name. I feel like that
O'Connell,
Rick O'Connell.
Yeah, O'Connell is not a good name to yell.
The fact that she calls him O'Connell constantly,
right,
right.
But it is such a old timey Hollywood name, right? It's like that.
Feels like calling it out is an old Hollywood thing,
right?
O'Connell.
Yeah, it's just like Rick O'Connell is. I don't know. Indiana Jones is pretty hard to beat, I guess.
Totally.
So. I mean, Indiana Jones is kind of a terrible name, right? Like, let's be clear about that.
But it's so cool. Like,
I agree.
Indy. Like, you
it
can yell Indy.
And Indy, yeah, it works. But yeah. His name is Indiana. They named the dog Indiana. Like, come on.
I just was thinking a lot about the character design, though, of Rick O'Connell when I was watching it this time and why he's so great. And if you guys have thoughts on this, I am so curious to hear them. It's not just because he is incredibly gorgeous and has the coolest costumes in this movie, which he really does, and also has the coolest guns all the time. Mm-hmm. And like
great hair, great pants.
Like, in that opening sequence when he's like reloading and he's got a bullet in his teeth and he's just like backing up and he's like pulling bullets out of his teeth to put them in his rifle. Come on. Anyway.
The guns kind of like they're cool, but it's also just like adult me is sort of like, that's really like, what's better than one gun? Two guns. How much ammo does he have in them? As much ammo as we need for the sound effects to fill until we've decided that now he needs to reload his six shooters that he just shot 40 shots from. It's a little silly, but it is cool. I feel like it's part of the whole. Right. Yeah.
It's like playing with guns, like toy guns as a kid is basically how the actors are treating the guns.
Right.
This must have been post Tomb Raider also, because I feel like Tomb Raider kind of popularized
infinite
the, you know,
gun.
Lara Croft running around with her dual pistols is kind of an iconic thing.
Right.
Yeah. But I think too, one of the things that makes him so lovable is he's very quick and impulsive almost, where he's decisive in his actions and he's just a man of action that doesn't think or talk about what's he's going to do. He just does things. And that both works to his advantage a lot in this movie, and it also gets him into trouble sometimes. His wit is one example of that. But also the, you know, the fact that, like, for example, he just punches Jonathan through the bars of the jail cell and then kisses Evie through the bars of the jail cell. Both of those are just essentially gut reaction sort of things. He's just sort of seizing the opportunity without thinking them through or talking about what he's going to do next. And he makes a great leader of the team for this reason and sort of the perfect protagonist for this movie, because I feel like I see so many movies where the team is just sitting around arguing about what they're going to do and the hero's trying to like sell them a plan. And O'Connell does none of that. He's never trying to sell a plan to anyone. He's just off starting the next plan. And people kind of just have to follow along with whatever his plan is. I don't know, the perfect example of it is later in the movie where he's like, okay, Evie, you're going to stay here. You two guys are going to guard the door. And Jonathan, you're coming with me. And Evie's like, how dare you? I'm not going to do any of that. And he just picks her up and throws her into the room and shuts the doors and locks it and just walks away. But it's without breaking, you know, breaking expression, breaking his stride. He just is like immediately, I'm doing the plan. I'm not even going to like argue with you about it. And it keeps the action moving. But also, again, it gets him into trouble sometimes where the first thing he does when he meets the mummy is shoot it. And he thinks that's handled it. Right. He's like, no, I got him. I definitely got him. It's all fixed and handled. So being a man of action is sort of perfect for this, where we buy that he can handle things as they're thrown at him because he's very quick. But also, yeah, it just like saves us from talking too much. It just keeps the movie keeps the movie fun.
Right. It also helps us as the audience to not spend too much time thinking about it when all the other characters want to make their plans and stuff like that. He's like, oh, let's just do this now.
Exactly.
Well, and I think it's that he is a man of action, but he also listens. Like, he can listen to reason. Because I feel like he's also kind of being contrasted with the other Americans, right? Who are, you know, like the British people call them cowboys. And there's, you know, the one guy that I just wish was Josh Holloway. Like, every time I see his face, I'm like, I wish you were Josh Holloway instead. Right. He would be so much more likable.
He's not supposed to be likable.
Well, true. But like, you know.
There's also the Josh Brolin looking guy. Like,
oh, right.
Yeah, all the Americans look like somebody else. It's weird.
They
like,
do.
Right. Some recast with the Joshes.
Right. My recognition brain kept going, oh, is that? No, it's not. Oh, is that? No, it's not.
Right, exactly. Like, I wanted him to be Sawyer. He'd be much better. Anyway, you know, there's the moment where they're in the tomb, they're digging, and there's that kind of, you know, scary moment of like, we're on one side of the statue, we're going to turn the corner, and oh, surprise, it's the other team. They're also here, mm-hmm. and everybody's got their guns out, and it's like a gun standoff, blah, blah, blah.
Really fun.
And then Evie realizes that, like, what they actually need is beneath them. There's another solution to this plan that isn't just, let's react and shoot. And she's able to signal that to Rick, and Rick gets it and, like, goes along. And so I feel like that he's a leader in terms of, like you're saying, Trisha, let's just, like, keep going. Like, let's not stop. Like, let's make sure we have momentum. But he also listens to good ideas and reason. And so it's not like he's overriding his team. It's like he and Evie create this kind of the, you know, a balance, the thing that you want of like,
exactly.
She's kind of the brains and she, and he's the action, but that kind of gets like, you know, they have fun with that too. So I feel like that's, it's the balance that he's not all the way to the, you know, the dumb Americans, and he's kind of, he's in this in-between place where he can be active, but also like listen and compassionate.
And that's a really good and smart contrast to Indiana Jones, because Indiana Jones by this point had become, you know, such the iconic adventurer. But Indiana Jones himself is a professor. So he has to also be smart. Right. He also has to, Indiana Jones has to puzzle and like uncover clues and do the sort of, yeah, treasure hunt kind of like put things together part. But here with the split where you have two of them, you have Evie to do the puzzling and uncovering the clues and all of that stuff. And then you have Rick to do all of the action and the, you know, the gunfighting and everything. And it's just cool that at no point, because they've separated those traits out into those two different characters, you never think of him as being very similar to Indiana Jones. He really is his own sort of distinctive character that, right. you know, has kind of become iconic from this movie.
It's interesting how I've noticed on Twitter and just online recently, there's a lot of people that are nostalgic for this movie, like recently. I've seen tweets that are like, this is the ultimate movie for bisexuals, and it's just like a picture of Rachel Weisz and Brendan Fraser.
There's
and
a lot of thirst about the cast.
There's a lot of thirst about this movie, yeah.
Which makes sense.
But yeah, I feel like it holds an iconic place for a certain generation, and it's weirdly kind of coming back into consciousness right now for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now that we've talked about Brendan Fraser, can we talk about the absolute star of this movie, Rachel Weisz, and how damn good she is in this.
And how adorable she is.
Sound she makes when riding her camel is like the cutest thing in the world. But it is one of those roles where it's like, you set her up as this sort of nerdy character. But then a lot, like a lesser movie would just be like, well, that's who this character is, right? But it's sort of like she gets to be that, but also funny and also graceful and like, you know, a person of action at some point and like that kind of thing. And it's just, it's like a nice character in the sense that she gets to be so well-rounded, but also just Rachel Weisz is one of those actors who's so like, not afraid to do anything, right? Like she, whatever this scene calls for, she will do it to 100%. And it just makes her so watchable throughout the whole movie and so engaging.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The character is very charming because the character herself has no real, she's not putting on anything. Like she's very earnest. She's very straightforward. She's openly nerdy and excited about Egyptology.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because, you know, it's in this moment in time, maybe, and also just because of the way the movie is calling back to old Hollywood tropes, she kind of gets to both be the modern brains of the operation, kind of like female protagonist, but also she gets to be like total damsel in distress and old Hollywood moments of getting kissed by the dead thing and being strapped up at the end to the like, sacrifice altar to be rescued. So it's an interesting blend of both, you know, the kind of 90s woman where it's like, I'm the smart one. I'm, you know, you all be lost without me. And yet also she kind of gets to do the classic old Hollywood thing all in the same movie, which is, it's a rare combo. You don't usually it'd be, you know, today, once again, we might swing all the way to she's almost one dimensional in this new way, in this 21st century way where it's like, I am basically like a one dimensional perfect like brainiac person, and I don't even get to have fun because I'm like very serious, and that's like, that's no fun either. Like,
right.
I like the combo we get to have here,
and she's radiant.
Yeah.
And she's smiling so much in this movie.
Yes.
That I was just realizing as I was watching it this time, just how much her smile like lights up everything around her. It's exactly what you're talking about, Alex. It's the earnestness of the character and how she's so thrilled to be there. And even when the mummy is like trying to kill her, she's a little bit excited that like anything is happening to her.
A mummy is
her.
Trying to kill her. Yeah. Right. That's crazy.
Like when things are happening, she's not scared. She keeps her wits about her, for one, which is also just wonderful, right? Where like she's just reading the hieroglyphics as fast as she can while sort of, you know, everything is sort of devolving around her. And she's like, patience is a virtue, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
She also, just has this sort of refreshing joy at being in this movie at all. And like in this adventure, right? And that's such a lovely character to have, where she's not scared, she's never like screaming, she's never crying, she doesn't want to go home, she wants to be there.
Right.
She's super game. She is the one who drags him out onto this like adventure because she's so excited to go on this adventure. You know, she rescues him, she buys him out of prison to take him on an adventure. And that's just a lovely, you know, sort of secondary protagonist to have.
It reminds me of her character in The Brothers Bloom, which also is a very earnest, sweet kind of go-getter character who wants adventure. And she's somehow, Rachel Weisz seems to be particularly good at capturing that just charm and energy, and the smiling is really special.
Yeah,
right.
Well, it's funny because I was just looking at her filmography, and I think that she's someone who didn't really come to my attention until a good 5 or 6 years later, since I didn't see this movie. And I think she sort of around that time developed a, not necessarily typecasting, but she was often playing a sort of more stoic adult character, you know, which she also does incredibly well. So it was very refreshing to see her as this like younger, more excitable, you know, very smiley kind of character. Because it's like, oh, that's also Rachel Weisz. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I always knew her as the girl from The Mummy.
Right.
Of course.
Right. Like how I knew her.
Yeah. When for our episode on The Favorite, I was watching a lot of interviews with her, and there was a question about like, how did you go about, you know, kind of crafting your character? And she's such like an interesting role model for women and blah, blah, blah. And Rachel Weisz was like, at that time, I was just excited to be cast in a thing. Like I was a young actor and I was just so I feel like perhaps some of that just genuine excitement that she had to be there, like, helped that character like bring some of that energy to it. And just like the idea of smiling, I want someone who has more time on their hands than me to create a chart of the amount of screen time per movie with smiling in it,
right,
over time, because I feel like we don't smile anymore.
We don't smile
in movies. Like just the smiling per capita has dropped dramatically.
Yeah.
For our episode on Annihilation, join our Patreon.
Speaking of no smiles.
Zero smile film.
God. Yeah.
Or watch Devs for a zero smile limited series.
Yeah. Alex Garland does not like smiles. So watch his movies if you hate smiling.
Yeah. I guess the other word I'm looking for her is curious, right? She has this curiosity, which is what, you know, inspired her to be an Egyptologist and makes her so excited about the adventure and everything. But it enables her to ask questions, and her curiosity is what makes her game. But also it like kind of leads to some of the most charming and iconic scenes in this. I love the scene where she on the riverboat where she just asks him why he kissed her.
Right.
She's like, why did you kiss me? And he's just like, you know, has the most Rick answer of all time.
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
I was about to be hanged. It seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
But that's just a lovely exchange where, you know, he's so ready to deal with the next problem.
Mm.
And again, like sort of opportunistic, right? Kind of thing. Like that's what makes him roguish. And she just has this delightful curiosity where she's not afraid to ask him to his face. And then I love the scene afterward where she's like brushing her hair and she's like, well, it wasn't that good of a kiss anyway, but she's so distracted by it. It's just, I don't know. I love the romance in this movie is really charming, not just because of their characters, but because it's part of the text. Like the movie doesn't go out of its way to put them at odds or ignore that the romance is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like both of those things feel contrived, where they're not doing a Han and Leia like, well, I don't like you. Well, you do too. They're not doing that. And they're also not like just acting like, oh, we're thrown together, right? Mm-hmm. Where accidentally this thing has knocked me into your arms. That also feels very contrived. But there's this sweetness to this romance where he immediately is checking on her after like a skirmish or whatever. And there's, I don't know, I was looking at it this time and there's this one scene where she's just, he checks on her. He's like, are you okay? And then she just stands there and he just kind of holds her and there, someone is like telling exposition to them. And she's just sort of in his arms and it's sort of just midway through, but it's just this very cute, it feels more genuine than I think either one of those other two options, which feel a little more tired and also, yeah, not as, just more tired.
Yeah.
As tropes. Well,
I feel like even like the cadence of how the relationship builds is interesting because, you know, he kisses her without permission. And so it's a little bit like, you scoundrel. Dog, how dare you? Yeah, yeah, you scoundrel. So then she's like, ugh, that guy. And then you see him and he's all like cleaned up and it's Brendan Fraser. And so you get like, okay, well now maybe she's into it, but maybe he's not there. Like, I feel like he only kind of gives, like starts to vocalize an attraction after they've like spent time together. And he's sort of saying like, I can't figure her out. So it feels like they kind of both eventually arrive at a like attraction, not just because you are the man here and I am the woman here, but after spending time with each other and like what the other one means, you know, they're each kind of like a reflection, like a mirror for each other a little bit. And like, I think she's kind of using him to figure out like, who am I? Am I an adventurer? Or like, I don't know. There's just more happening there than just we are the male and female leads. And so we must be in a relationship. And it's hard to pick apart, but I feel like it does elevate it and make it something special. And it's just, again, it's Brendan Fraser, Rachel Weisz in that.
It's chemistry.
Does so much work. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. They have great, great chemistry, but also it's in the writing. Like, and I think it is definitely in the characters and clearly in the direction here where the way that they're sort of like, yeah, blocked at every moment where he's sort of always watching out for her, you know, and she is watching out for him, as you pointed out earlier, Michael, where the bullets are coming and she reaches over and grabs him and saves him and that kind of thing.
Yeah. The Mummy Returns is like a whole other thing. I don't know if you guys rewatched that. That was...
Well, I remember, don't they have a kid?
They do. Movie?
So they have a kid. They're married, and also like the movie like jumps the shark. Like if you think... Like it goes crazy and
that the one mummy jumps the shark.
Yeah, Brian, did you see The Mummy Returns?
No, but my question is the kid British? And if so, what does he refer to Rachel Weisz as?
Yes, and I can't remember.
Because if it's mum? Well, if it's mummy, then I'm out.
Stop it. Somebody,
I mean,
kick
don't
him.
Tell me that's not the kind of thing that would happen in the sequel to this movie.
I mean, that's the kind of thing that could happen in this movie.
Anyway, all right. Well, I won't say any more about The Mummy Returns, but Brian, I want you to go watch it and then report. Like, I want to hear, we need to debrief about what you make of
because that. Because you love The Mummy so much, you now need to go watch the sequel.
Yeah, I want to see, because it goes places.
But it is this thing of like, did I have fun? Yeah. And am I curious about spending more time in this world? Yeah. You know, so it's just like, am I excited about the idea of watching a movie that I would probably like less? Like, no, but at the same time, I like, you know, just hearing you guys talk about The Mummy and remembering scenes and stuff. I'm just like having fun remembering that, you know, like you said, Alex, there's a sort of immersion to it where you're like, I feel like I can walk around in this world and like actually be with these characters and it sort of feels like a ride. And that is fun. And that's why I could see there being a sort of clamoring for so much more, you know, in this franchise, basically, that happened over the following 10 years with next two Mummy movies and then Scorpion King. And then I think there was like another Scorpion King movie, right? Like just it kind of kept going for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want a Disneyland scale experience of like the Mummy universe. I think that'd be really fun to go just like, literally walk around in.
The Mummy ride at Universal Studios is still one of the best rides over there, to be honest.
I mean, like, it's not much of like an experience though, besides just like shooting you through like darkness really quick, right? It's just like an indoor roller coaster.
Yeah, but sorry, Universal Studios just doesn't have any good rides anymore.
So, like, it's true. They don't have much space. They're like on a hill, you know.
Yeah, they didn't have any space. But the Mummy ride is a really good one by comparison to most of the other ones at Universal Studios. Correct.
Right. It's actually a ride. It's not a motion. Yeah. Oh,
sorry. So sad. Sorry. This took a turn.
Yeah.
All right. Well, why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take from The Mummy. Before we dive into lessons, I want to take a moment to thank all the patrons who support the show. We've been doing Beyond Screenplay for over 2 years now, which is kind of hard to believe.
Oh, my gosh.
And we want to make sure we can keep doing it for years to come. So if you are enjoying the show, we'd really appreciate your support. There are lots of ways to support Beyond the Screenplay. Simply telling a friend about it is always useful. Most podcasts grow via word of mouth. Checking out our sponsors always helps and encourages them to keep sponsoring the show. And of course, you can support us on Patreon. When you join, you can get access to our Discord and chat with a growing community of fellow film nerds. Get access to 24 patron-exclusive episodes. Wow. I counted those, which makes sense, I guess, 2 years.
Yeah.
There's a new one every month. And you will help us get closer to reaching our goal, which, as Brian mentioned earlier, when we hit 750 patrons, we'll do a three-part series on the Indiana Jones movies and then a special patron-exclusive on refrigerators and aliens and crystal skulls. But clearly, we have a lot of thoughts about this adventure genre, and I feel like I just want to talk about Indiana Jones now.
Mm-hmm.
Help us grow the show and join our awesome community over at patreon.com/beyondthescreenplay. All right, lessons from The Mummy. Trisha, start us off.
I love Betty. I'm going to talk about Betty for a minute. It is awesome to have a henchman. I don't know. I feel like there aren't great henchmen anymore. This used to be a staple of action adventure movies. The James Bond henchmen are some of the most iconic characters in the James Bond series. And I'm sorry, hench people.
hench persons.
I'm sorry. Use the gender
neutral. The politically correct term for hench. For hench. things. Yes.
But Betty is a great one. He starts off as this like tentative ally. He's one of the first characters we meet. We actually meet him before we meet the Rachel Weisz character. And he manages to continue, like, I don't know, he's sort of always maneuvering and pushing the plot whenever he needs to, but he also has a lot of personality. And is just wonderful to hate, you know? And part of that is Kevin J. O'Connor's performance, which is fantastic in this. But it's also just a cleverly utilized character. Because you often have to keep your villain and your hero from really confronting each other too soon, right? You got to keep them apart. And a henchman is a great way to do that. Where you can tie up your hero fighting with the henchman. And you can keep your villain like a big, scary bad and save him for the climax. And this movie utilizes Benny to do that really well. A good henchman is a great device and also a fun character for actors to play and can end up being an iconic character. And Benny's death in this is wonderful. Like, Benny makes it longer than the mummy does. He outlives the mummy and he almost gets away. And then he has that such a great death right at the end. I just feel like the art of the henchman has really been lost. And Benny is a very, very good one.
Yeah. That's a really great point. And then he shows up and there will be blood and you're like, wait a minute, where do I know this person from? And then you look up on IMDb and like, wait, he's the guy from the mummy? That was my experience anyway.
That's funny.
And also the scene where Rick is kicking the crap out of him to get information is just a really, really great scene.
Where he's threatening like throwing him with against, the ceiling fan.
Throwing him against one wall, throwing him over here. And I also just, a good henchman who does have like shifting loyalties and, you know, might give up the bad guy, right? He's not like a true believer. And so, again, just a good plot device, just well utilized, is refreshing.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian, what about you?
That actually ties in really nicely with my lesson, which is about the ensemble cast and this sort of dual function it serves on either half of the movie. So in the first half of the movie, they create this constant tension of, as you were saying, Trisha, where do their allegiances lie and what are they going to do? So it's like, is the brother going to turn on them? Is the doctor going to turn on them? Is Benny, maybe he'll end up being trustworthy. Maybe he'll be the sort of classic henchman who gets a heart at the last minute and decides to, you know, stop the villain or whatever. And then you have Oded Fehr's character, Ardeth Bey, who and his whole group of people, where the first half of the movie, his job is just to like say cryptic things from a hill mostly. But then when they actually show up, you're like, oh, what are these guys going to do? What's their interest? And then, of course, you have all these other treasure hunters, the Americans, which gives the story not only tension, but also a nice sense of urgency. It's not just you get to hang out and just wait till you're ready to go do this. It's no, there's a race now to get to this thing, right?
A literal race.
Right. But then at the midpoint of this movie, it becomes a horror movie. And what do you need for a good horror movie but a large cast of disposable nobodies?
Yep.
That's an excellent point.
Right. So then now we have all these people we've introduced and we're like, but you don't care about any of them. So let's watch them all get killed. So there's this interesting sort of parabolic arc, right? Where we have over the first half, more and more cast members joining, more and more characters joining the cast. And then after the midpoint, they all start fading away basically as they become mummy fodder. So it's kind of nice to see the cast serving that dual purpose. It's not just once the mummy comes out, then they just don't matter anymore. It's like, no, we have these characters. Now let's use them for this sort of other subgenre of movie that it turns into at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I like that. Alex, what about you?
My lesson is often the lesson that I jump to, which is about the promise of the premise, which is I just love a movie that leaves nothing on the table. Is that the... And now I'm having a Michael Brain, like, idiom questioning.
yeah.
It leaves nothing on the table because everything went into it.
I think so.
You know what I mean. Basically,
it leaves no tomb unrated.
There you go.
Exactly. Yeah, this is a movie that's not saving something for a sequel, even though they made a sequel because they made a lot of money. It's thinking about, okay, I'm going to do a throwback adventure, Egypt mummy curse movie. Like, what are all the things that implies? We're going to do the treasure hunters. We're going to do the biblical plagues. We're going to do ancient curses. We're going to do the requisite scenes at the end with, like, the Indiana Jones walls coming in and you're escaping. Like, we're going to do all of it. And then we're going to do it a little bit more with, like, CG mummies, you know, doing backflips and Brendan Fraser fighting them. Like, it's the kind of movie that when it gets to that finale, it's already given me everything I want, and then but it's still going, and it reminds me of Pirates of the Caribbean in that way, where it's like Pirates kind of feels like a movie and a half, where it's like I've gotten what I came for, but we're still going, and it's still awesome, and it's still fun. It's not getting tiresome, and The Mummy has that same feeling of just we're gonna do it all, and we're gonna do it in a varied enough way that you don't get tired of it. You actually are excited about the ride the whole time up until that last frame when they ride off into the sunset, and which is perfect. I guess the lesson is if you get this chance to do a big high concept thing, just do it all the way. Think about what an audience wants from this kind of movie and just do it. And if you get to make a sequel later, great. You'll have to figure that out later. But in this first right. movie, give us everything we want with a movie called The Mummy.
Yeah. Certain kinds of genres are not about restraint. Just right. everything and yes. the kitchen sink. Right. Just put it right in there.
Like if Pirates had saved some piratey things for like the next movie, that wouldn't have worked. It's like, no, just do it all here. We're going to have the pirate ship like direct battling. We're going to have the undead curses. We're going to have it all in this one movie. And once again, you'll have to figure out some weird stuff for the sequels because we've already done it.
Right. right. Maybe not the best recipe for sequels, but it's the best right. recipe for a good movie.
Yeah.
Right.
Correct.
There is one little action thing that I think we can be done with as movies forever, which The Mummy does and The Fifth Element does, which is a character is about to sort of, it's usually a side shot, and a character is about to hit an enemy, but there's an enemy coming up behind them. And we don't know if they know that the enemy's coming up behind them. And then either on purpose or by accident, with the backswing before they're about to hit the enemy in front of them, they take out the enemy behind them. I'm like, and granted, The Mummy is 20 plus years ago, but I'm like, I've seen this happen so many times in movies now that I don't need to see it ever again. That'd be fine.
I also love the like Han Solo style, like charge run away. Around the corner, come charging right back around.
Followed by enemies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Followed by enemies.
Yeah.
One other thing that made me think of Pirates and just a ton of movies is the way that Imhotep is literally about to complete his task. Like he's raising the dagger to do the thing, to finish everything. And there's like a disruption in the corner. And so he stops and he's like, I'm going to go right. check out what's happening over here.
Yeah.
It's like, you could have just finished and like been like immortal and done, but you decided to like stop, check out this sound just to double
the
check.
The ruckus.
Yeah.
Or the classic, like you just cut my arm off. So I'm going to throw you towards the other side of the room and then walk towards you slowly. Like, wait, what?
I do feel like the first time you see Imhotep and he's in the hotel room or whatever. And after like, Brendan Fraser empties his 40 shots from his two little guns, the mummy just comes up, walks, and just kind of tosses him across the room.
Yeah.
And it's like, I feel like you could have done so much more. Like, you're putting distance between you and your target. Anyway. Yeah.
Sorry, one thing I wanted to call out was how much the movie it really enjoys the jaw stretching effect that it figured out.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like really right. embraces that. Like, all mummies can drop their jaws and it's horrifying. And we're going to do it
like a snake
over and over again.
Right. Inspiring Pirates and I Am Legend and all you're those right. things. Mm-hmm. This all sort of ties into my lesson, which is, you know, I mentioned earlier, I like it when movies don't worry about too much verisimilitude. Like, mm-hmm. sometimes I just want to go to a theater and the movie starts and it feels like it's telling me, I'm just going to tell you a story. Like, this is a story. You don't have to think it's true. Like, I'm not going to spend a bunch of time. Like, we're just going to have fun and we're going to tell you a story and just, like, sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. And it doesn't mean that, like, it, you know, it still has to be well constructed and well written. And there are, I think, things about the script that are, again, maybe not good, but great. Like, even if all the beats don't maybe always make sense how you got there, they're always the beats you want to be at. And within them, they're doing the thing. And I don't know. I really appreciate this kind of tone that, as we've been saying, is missing of just like, it's just gonna be a movie. Like, sometimes I just want someone to make a movie and just show me a movie and not.
I think the thing that I was mentioning earlier, I think there's this thing with like IP world building that's happening right now that doesn't let movies be movies. You know, it's like, this is just one chapter of some right. bigger grand plan. And so this can't just be a movie. It's got to actually lay a foundation of like a new
universe.
Yeah. Speaking of other mummy movies.
Yeah. Things that are the most opposite of this also, like, it's so, it has none of the things that are good about the mummy in it. No. Anyway,
2017 mummy. Whole,
yeah. That's the, oh boy. What have you guys been watching recently? Brian, tell me about what you've been watching recently.
So at the end of our Paddington episode, we had a mini Sally Hawkins love fest, and I wanted to keep it going. So I was looking into her filmography, and I discovered a movie I'm not sure I ever heard of. It's called Maudie from 2016, directed by Aisling Walsh, and it stars Sally Hawkins and Ethan Hawke. So you got, you got double the Hawk. yes, Michael just... shadow puppeted a hawk for all of you listeners out there. But Sally Hawkins plays Maud Lewis, who is a real life folk artist from Nova Scotia, who her paintings became famous toward the end of her life in about the 1960s. And she had severe arthritis, and she was sort of basically really challenging for her to move towards the end of her life, but she was still making paintings and, you know, doing everything she could. The movie at least paints her as this, no pun intended, treats her as this social outcast by her family and the people around her. And towards the beginning of the story, she moves in with Ethan Hawke, who is sort of another social outcast, just a very gruff bear of a man who's a fish peddler. And fish peddler. But no, it sort of follows their relationship and how her paintings start to take off and all that kind of thing. And the movie is good, but the performances, the two of them are just bananas on toast amazing, as you would expect. Sally Hawkins, just insanely good. Like, why was this performance not all over the world when, you know, it happened? But also, I usually have trouble whenever Ethan Hawke tries to pretend he's not Ethan Hawke in a movie.
Sure.
Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. I'm like, don't pretend you're this, you know, person, you're whatever. Like, you're just Ethan Hawke. Just be Ethan Hawke. I like you best that way. But he totally nails it for this character. He just slips into the performance in a way where I feel like I forget I'm watching Ethan Hawke. So the two of them, both the performances together, but also their interaction with each other is really beautiful. Maudie, M-A-U-D-I-E, 2016. Check it out.
Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome. Cool. All right. Trisha, what have you been watching?
So my sister was visiting me recently because vaccines and things are opening and people can fly on planes now and all that stuff. And we were looking for something to watch when she was here. And she was like, have you been watching Queer Eye? And I was like, no, because for some reason, I don't know, I was trying to act like reality TV is beneath me or something, which it definitely is not. Like, I love Great British Baking Show as much as anybody else does, and also HGTV house shows and things like that. So I do watch like versions of, you know, reality shows or whatever, but I was like, Queer Eye, ha, absolutely. I do not watch that makeover show you speak of. It is amazing, and I've like basically watched all of Queer Eye, and nice. It's just such a tonic for my heart. Like, I don't know, I just really have been loving it. It's so good, and so much of it was filmed like, so it's on your Netflix, by the way, and it is a makeover show, but they do all the things. Like, they fix the person's house, and they like teach them to cook, and they also like fix their wardrobe, and they also like fix their hair and grooming. And they also like fix their life as much as they can, where they try to like repair relationships in their life and things like that. It's great. And they've, you know, done different seasons. There was a season in Kansas City. There was a season in Atlanta. And they go to, you know, often places where, you know, there isn't a lot of queer culture. And they kind of like.
Right. I was going to say when you said those cities.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And they roll into areas where they like may not be welcome, and there are people on the show that you would not expect to ever be on the show, where you're like, who nominated you for this? What made you say yes? Like, you know, and but you, I don't know, the show is just like really well put together, and I'm sure there's the veneer of reality TV is over it, and it's edited heavily to make it into this little sort of heartwarming, you know, hour long package of like someone from rural Missouri learned about how much, you know, the Fab Five could influence them to get over their divorce and reconnect with their kids. And you're like, okay, probably not. But like, I love that story.
Right.
I don't know. It's just, it's really great. It's just really, really great.
Get rid of the verisimilitude. Just tell the story. All like, right. That's all we care
about.
There
you go.
Right. And the personalities of the guys. Look, you guys all watch it. Why am I telling you what Queer Eye is? Like, it's awesome. I just want to tell you. I really, really love it.
I have not seen any, but Wikipedia tells me that the fifth season is based in Philadelphia. So I'm going to go watch that immediately.
Yes. I mean, and it is great. They do, it's such a well-produced show. They do such a good job of getting a cross-section of people from all walks of life to be a part of this, like, sort of, yeah, a little makeover experience. So they've, like, had, like, a young doctor who's, like, just finished her residency, and she is, you know, like, starting her full-time career. And then they also have, like, a farmer, and they have a firefighter, and then they have, like, a man who is disabled because he was shot in the abdomen. Like, they do a really great job of telling different people's stories. So strongly recommend. If for some reason, like me, you thought you were above Queer Eye, I'm here to tell you, you are not.
Nice.
Excellent. Well, so I've mentioned before that I have this weird relationship with Scorsese films and Shutter Island in particular, where I decide I want to watch it, get hooked, come away liking it, think about it more, and then I'm like, wait, did I like that or do I not like that movie? And then like a year passes, and then I'm like, I think I want to watch Shutter Island, and I just like do the whole thing over again. So I just watched Shutter Island again. but I feel like I've completed my arc with it, and I think part of what I've identified is that the first time I saw it, you know, it's a movie that's twisty and playing with your perception of reality and what is and what isn't. And the way it ends left a question in my mind that I've been trying to answer every time I watch it. And I think I've finally found the answer and have resolved any like unresolved feelings I had with it. And I can't say any more without completely spoiling the movie.
I want to talk to you about this.
I think like The Mummy, I don't know that it's like a good movie, but it's kind of great. And I think I really, really like it. That's where I've come down on it. So perhaps my last Shutter Island rewatch is what I've done recently. And thumbs up.
Interesting.
Because I just tried to watch this for the first time. And I tried to watch it for the first time and I bailed on it about 25, 30 minutes in.
But you should watch it. Like, I get it. It's, I feel like it acts like it's scarier than it is.
Yeah,
it's,
that was the
it's
reason.
It's a whole thing. Yeah, I know.
It was late at night.
Sure. Don't watch it late at night. But I think it's really interesting and it'd be fun to talk about it at some point.
Yeah, I watched it once and was like, okay. And that's the end of my relationship with that movie. So I'd be interested to watch it again.
Right. I think that's probably what most people's is, but yeah, it's stuck in my brain, but I think I finally cracked it.
Okay. Yeah.
And Alex, last but not least, I know you watched something on CuriosityStream, who is back again as the sponsor of this episode. CuriosityStream, if you don't know, is the streaming service featuring thousands of documentaries and nonfiction titles. Alex, what did you watch?
So I watched The Kingdom, How Fungi Made Our World, or Fungi. I don't know. They say it a bunch of different ways in the documentary. Like
Fungi?
Fungi, yeah. Fungi, fungi, fungi. I heard it like all three ways by scientists in the documentary. Anyway, it's a documentary about fungi, however you want to say it. And it's really fascinating. It's a good companion piece to another documentary I recommended some episode way back when called Fantastic Fungi, which is a really fun doc. But this one on CuriosityStream is a little bit more about natural history and about the role that this weird thing, this separate kingdom from plants and animals, fungi, it played this really crucial role in helping basically life move out of the ocean and onto land. Like it basically made it possible for plants to proliferate over the land, made it possible for mammals to really like take over the world after the dinosaurs. So basically we're all here because of this weird mushroom thing. And it gets really into just all these different steps at which it was a crucial part of evolution. And then it gets into some really horrifying stuff near the end about how climate change is making it so types of fungi that normally wouldn't be in like our habitats is going to start coming out, which may be like lethal and kill people. So it ended on a really like disturbing note. It felt like an outbreak in Vancouver in recent years where people were like getting infected with a thing that was never seen outside of Australia before. So anyway, lots of great stuff. And I really am fascinated with fungi and mushrooms and the way they interact with forests. It's just a weird alien thing. And I think the science on it is still kind of new. So really worth checking out on CuriosityStream.
I think there was like a radio lab that I listened to that was kind of about that. It feels like maybe it was like the Cliff Notes version of this documentary. And it was really fascinating, just like how much of evolution was shaped by this thing that we kind of didn't think about at all, but is like the reason everything is the way it is. So that's cool. I'm excited about it. Awesome. All right. Well, if you, listener, want to check out The Kingdom, How Fungi Made Our World, and support Beyond the Screenplay, sign up for CuriosityStream at curiositystream.com/screenplay. The link is in the show notes. And when you sign up for CuriosityStream, you also get free access to Nebula, which is the streaming service featuring exclusive and ad-free content from some of the best educational creators out there, including many of our past guests, Lindsay Ellis, Maggie Mae Fish, Patrick Willems, Just Right, and many, many more. So sign up for CuriosityStream at curiositystream.com/screenplay or by using the link in the show notes. This has been our conversation about The Mummy. This was a lot of fun. I'm glad we finally got a chance to do this because we've been talking about it internally for a long time. So I'm glad we went for it. I really want to make Brian watch the sequel.
All right.
Maybe we shall get together and...
Because we can do that soon. Now.
That's right. Oh,
God. Yay.
Mummy Returns live stream in 1 week.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, yes, this has been our conversation about The Mummy. Thank you, as always, to the patrons for making the show possible. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major, and our editor, Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Cayeros. All of our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and say hi, and we will see you in the next episode.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.